This session is entitled, What Does Dr. Seuss Know About Justice? And I'm Bill Grace, and this is...
Maren Hinderle.
The way we're going to do this is share a couple of concepts around justice, and then Maren is going to read us a wonderful book by Dr. Seuss. And what we're going to ask you to do is, as you're hearing this story, maybe again, but hearing it for the first time, possibly, in relation to justice, could you listen to the story with some of the concepts that I'm about to share in mind? And I'm just going to take about 5 or 10 minutes to share some concepts, and we'll hear the story. And the goal will be to try to, in our reflections, to weave those concepts into our hearing of the story. The first one concept I'd like to share just briefly is the question of what is community? It's difficult for justice to occur outside of community. So one of the things we need to conceive of first is, what does community look like? And maybe more so specifically, what does Christian community look like? For those who were here last week, this may be a little bit repetitious, but I think a couple new additions. The first person I'd like to cite in his reflections on community is Parker Palmer. Parker Palmer is a theologian and an educator, and I like this a lot. He's a consultant, travels a lot, but he doesn't call himself a consultant. He calls himself a traveling teacher, and that just sounds a little bit less like a snake oil salesman. He says this about community. He says, two rules automatically fall into place anytime we try to create a community. The first rule is this, is that the last person in the world that you'd like to show up in your community shows up. Been there, right? And that the second rule of community is that as soon as we're clever enough to get that person to leave, somebody else comes to take his or her place. So, sort of like the theme at Holden this year, Parker Palmer says that community is dependent upon creating space where the stranger feels welcome. The community, you know you have community when you have space where strangers feel welcome. And I don't know about you, but for me, that is, and I'm losing his name at the moment, Speaker of the House?
Gingrich.
He is the person that I would like to estrange in my life. I would be creating authentic community if Newt Gingrich felt comfortable in my classroom or in my home or in my organization. So what space can I create to make people who I would keep out feel welcome? And at the center where I work, we call that space gracious space. Filled with grace, filled with the love of God, filled with the unconditional love of God for all people. The next person, just to reflect on briefly on community, is Pericles. And he was giving it was called the funeral oration. It was the end of the Peloponnesian Wars, and many Athenians had died in battle. They'd been at war with Sparta for a long time. And Pericles was trying to help the Athenians to put some meaning behind the struggle that they went through and the loss of life. And he appealed to their core identity. And he said, even though the Peloponnesian Wars have caused us to suffer a great deal, and that, you know, Sparta has maybe proven themselves in some ways a better fighter, he believed that Athenian culture would be more long-lasting than Sparta for one reason and one reason alone. And that was because Pericles reminded them that in Athens, strangers were welcome to march in their parades. Not attend their parades, march in their parades. Sparta was a closed community. It was almost a cloistered community. The only people welcomed in Sparta were Spartans, people who were born Spartans and raised in a particular way, maybe with a sort of pure view of life, but a fairly narrow view of life. And he thought that that would ultimately be the demise of Sparta. And that Athens' strength was that it was a place where strangers were welcome to march in their parades. Last comment on community. I mentioned a couple times they have this sort of this biblical imagination. So I wondered at times, what would it be like to have Peter and Matthew in the same room? You know, Peter is this disciple. My image of Peter is that he's a rough and tumble fisherman, says what he thinks, and thinks some unkind thoughts at times, and is willing to say them, and was angry at Roman occupation, and would have probably taken a couple Roman soldiers on had he the opportunity some evening. Matthew, you know, pretty much the opposite from my perspective, is that the Romans were in town and he was hoping to get a little bit of that gravy, and he was going to be a tax collector and live off as well as he could the bad news of Roman occupation, and to see if he couldn't turn that into a little bit of luxury for himself. Jesus, in Jesus's wisdom, recruits them both to be on the same team. Now, in Jesus' presence, they tolerate each other. But one Saturday afternoon, just to test the disciples, Jesus decides to go shopping and leaves them alone. Now what do Peter and Matthew say to each other? And how did they create a setting and an understanding and a sense of community in the midst of their diversity? My sense is that they obviously did, in the light of Christ's love. But maybe that gives us some other insights into community. I'd really like to just share one more concept, and it's the concept of trusteeship. You know, some of you have worked at colleges, and you understand the college was responsible to a board of trustees. Holden Village, as a nonprofit organization, is responsible to a board of trustees. So what are trustees responsible for? And the question, and trusteeship has something to do with stewardship. This is the question I'd like you to think about. Can you recall a time when you were held in trust? Can you recall a time when you were held in trust? I would like to hear from some of you for just a bit, maybe a few minutes before we turn it over to Maren to read the story. And feel free to talk to your neighbor to sort of warm up to this. But recall a time when you were held in trust. Tell that story briefly, but what I would like you to be looking for is that what were the attributes of the person that held you in trust? Okay? So why don't you go ahead and if you just reflect on that when you're ready, talk to a neighbor about a time when you were held in trust, and what were the attributes of the people who were holding you in trust? Go ahead. And Maren and I will do the same. Yeah.
We have a trust relationship.
It's not an easy thing to co-present, you know, so that's right. Trust happens there for sure. I'm trying to recall a time. I remember telling Sandy something actually just within the last year, probably one of the last few secrets I had in my closet, and it was a really scary one, and I didn't want to tell anybody, but I knew I needed to get something off my chest, and I told Sandy, and it was only after 20 years of marriage, and that sort of has built into what I feel like. If we can now, we're not so much interested in hearing the particular story, although they're, I just heard a very powerful one, and they're typically powerful stories. But what we're trying to reflect on is what are the characteristics of those people who hold us in trust? Can you begin to describe the person or the organization? What characteristics did they have?
Confidence.
Okay, confidence.
Courage.
Vulnerability. Who said that?
I. Eva?
Up there. Okay. Is that you, Janet?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Vulnerability. How did vulnerability help someone hold you in trust?
Just to share what they shared and trusting me.
So it was a mutual. As you were opening yourself to them, they opened themselves to you so that they'd create more space for you to continue to open.
Mm-hmm. They have your interest at heart.
Mm-hmm. And they know that you have their interest in heart.
For me, it was the suspension of judgment. As I was sharing with Maren, I was getting something off my chest that had been there for a long while. Actually, in this case, it was with my wife. And there was a moment in me sharing what I had to share where there was a little bit of judgment in the room. But the moment that dissipated, and it was Sandy's choice, at that point, I felt like I was held in trust when judgment sort of drifted off. Anyone else? What are the characteristics of those who hold us in trust?
Well, this isn't like your example, but I was thinking about when I had hip replacement and I had gone to three different doctors and I picked the one who I thought, first of all, had the best skill, but he also had the best manner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So...
What was it about his manner?
Oh, he just really seemed very concerned about me as a person and doing the best. And I scheduled it for right after he got back from a conference because I thought he wouldn't be burnt out. You know, the first time I did it, I went to all these lengths to make sure it was great. And it was just as great as I hoped.
Let me just see if we can weave this together now so we can hear the story. Is that trusteeship and community, I believe, precede justice. But it's difficult for me to want to act on behalf of someone else and to care about them and to ensure justice in their lives if we have not been in community together. It's difficult for me to know them deeply enough. And until I recognize that I am empowered by God as trustee in their life, like all of us are, that God appears to not act directly in this world as often as God acts through us. So that justice is ensured by the degree to which we're willing to hold each other in trust. So if there's hunger somewhere in the community, God entrusts us to be trustees of the food in that community and the hunger to make sure that they meet each other. And if that's true, if community and trusteeship precede justice, then our question for you this evening is, what does Dr. Seuss know about justice? And so, Maren is going to read us a story.
Horton, here's a who. By Dr. Seuss.
And if you'd like to see pictures, you need to come up close. So Maren will probably hold them up.
I'll hold it up for you. This is for my great friend, Mitsugi Nakamura of Kyoto, Japan. On the 15th of May, in the jungle of Newell, in the heat of the day, in the cool of the pool, he was splashing, enjoying the jungle's great joys, when Horton the elephant heard a small noise. So Horton stopped splashing. He looked toward the sound. That's funny, thought Horton. There's no one around. Then he heard it again, just a very faint yelp, as if some tiny person were calling for help. I'll help you, said Horton, but who are you? Who? Where? He looked and he looked. He could see nothing there but a small speck of dust blowing past through the air. I say, murmured Horton, I've never heard tell of a small speck of dust that is able to yell. So you know what I think? Why, I think that there must be someone on top of that small speck of dust, some sort of a creature of very small size, too small to be seen by an elephant's eyes. Some poor little person who's shaking with fear that he'll blow in the pool. He has no one to steer. I'll just have to save him, because, after all, a person's a person, no matter how small. so gently and using the greatest of care, the elephant stretched his great trunk through the air, and he lifted the dust back and carried it over and placed it down safe on a very soft clover. Humph, humphed a voice. 'Twas a sour kangaroo, and the young kangaroo in her pouch said, humph, too. Why, that speck is as small as the head of a pin. A person on that? Why, there never has been. Believe me, said Horton, I tell you sincerely, my ears are quite keen, and I heard him quite clearly. I know there's a person down there, and what's more, quite likely there's two, even three, even four. Quite likely, a family, for all that we know. A family with children just starting to grow. So please, Horton said, as a favor to me, try not to disturb them. Just please, let them be. I think you're a fool, laughed the sour kangaroo. And the young kangaroo in her pouch said, me too. You're the biggest blank fool in the jungle of Nool. And the kangaroos plunged in the cool of the pool. What terrible splashing, the elephant frowned. I can't let my very small persons get drowned. I've got to protect them. I'm bigger than they. So he picked up the clover and hustled away. Through the high jungle tops, the news quickly spread. He talks to a dustback. He's out of his head. Just look at him walk with that speck on that flower. And Horton walked, worrying almost an hour. Should I put the speck down? Horton thought with alarm. If I do, these small persons may come to great harm. I can't put it down, and I won't, after all. A person's a person, no matter how small. Then Horton stopped walking. The speck voice was talking. The voice was so faint he could just barely hear it. Speak up, please, said Horton. He put his ear near it. My friend, came the voice. You're a very fine friend. You've helped all us folks on this dust speck no end. You've saved all our houses, our ceilings and floors. You've saved all our churches and grocery stores. You mean, Horton gasped, you have buildings there too? Oh, yes, piped the voice. We most certainly do. I know, called the voice. I'm too small to be seen, but I'm mayor of a town that is friendly and clean. Our buildings to you would seem terribly small, but to us, who aren't big, they are wonderfully tall. My town is called Whoville, for I am a Who, and we Whos are all thankful and grateful to you. And Horton called back to the mayor of the town, you're safe now. Don't worry. I won't let you down. But just as he spoke to the mayor of the speck, three big jungle monkeys climbed up Horton's neck. The Wickersham brothers were shouting, what rot? The elephant's talking to Whos who are not. There aren't any Whos. And they don't have no mayor, and we're gonna stop all this nonsense, so there. They smashed Horton's clover. They carried it off to a black-bottomed eagle named Vlad Vladikov. A mighty strong eagle, a very swift wing, and they said, will you kindly get rid of this thing? And before the poor elephant even could speak, that eagle flew off with a flower in his beak. All that late afternoon and far into the night, that black-bottomed bird flapped his wings in fast flight, while Horton chased after with groans over stones that tattered his toenails, battered his bones, and begged, please don't harm all my little folks. You have as much right to live as us bigger folks do. But far, far beyond him, that eagle kept flapping, and over his shoulder called back, quit your yapping. I fly through the night. I'm a bird. I don't mind it. And I'll hide this tomorrow where you'll never find it. and at 6:56 the next morning he did it. It sure was a terrible place that he hid it. He let that small clover drop somewhere inside of a great patch of clovers 100 miles wide. "For that," sneered the bird, "but I think you will fail." And he left with a flip of his black-bottomed tail. "I'll find it," cried Horton. "I'll find it or bust. I shall find my friends on my small speck of dust." And clover by clover by clover with care, he picked up and searched them and called, "Are you there?" But clover by clover by clover, he found that the one that he sought for was just not around. And by noon, poor old Horton, more dead than alive, had picked, searched, and piled up 9,005. Then, on through the afternoon, hour after hour, till he found them at last on the 3,000,000th flower. "My friends," cried the elephant, "tell me, do tell, are you safe, are you sound, are you whole, are you well?" From down on the speck came the voice of the mayor. We've really had trouble, much more than our share. When that black-bottomed birdie let go and we dropped, we landed so hard that our clocks have all stopped. Our teapots are broken, our rocking chairs smashed, and our bicycle tires all blew up when we crashed. "So Horton, please," pleaded that voice of the mayor's, "will you stick by us hoos while we're making repairs?" "Of course," Horton answered, "of course I will stick. I'll stick by you small folks through thin and through thick." With the help of the Wickersham brothers and dozens of Wickersham uncles and Wickersham cousins and Wickersham in-laws whose help I've engaged. Oh, wait, I'm sorry, I skipped a page. "Humph! Humph!" the voice. "For almost 2 days you've run wild and insisted on chatting with persons who've never existed. Such carryings on in our peaceable kingdom. We've had quite enough of your bellowing bungle. And I'm here to state," snapped the big kangaroo, "that your silly nonsensical game is all through." And the young kangaroo in her pouch said, "Me too." With the help of the Wickersham brothers and dozens of Wickersham uncles and Wickersham cousins and Wickersham in-laws whose help I've engaged, you're going to be roped and you're going to be caged. And as for your dust speck, ha, that we shall boil in a hot steaming kettle of bezel nut oil. "Boil it?" gasped Horton. "Oh, that you can't do. It's all full of persons. They'll prove it to you." Mr. Mayor, Horton called. "Mr. Mayor, you've got to prove now that you really are there. So call a big meeting, get everyone out. Make every who holler, make every who shout. Make every who scream. If you don't, every who is going to end up in a bezel nut stew." And down on the dust speck, the scared little mayor quick called a big meeting in Whoville town square. And his people cried loudly. They cried out in fear. "We are here! We are here! We are here! We are here!" The elephant smiled. "That was clear as a bell. You kangaroos surely heard that very well." "All I heard," snapped the big kangaroo, "was the breeze and the faint sound of winds through the far distant trees. I heard no small voices, and you didn't either." And the young kangaroo in her pouch said, "Me either." "Grab him," they shouted, "and cage the big dope. Lasso his stomach with 10 miles of rope. Tie the notes tight so he'll never shake loose. Then dunk that dumb speck in the bezel nut juice." Horton fought back with great vigor and vim, but the Wickersham gang was too many for him. They beat him, they mauled him, they started to haul him into his cage, but he managed to call to the mayor, "Don't give up! I believe in you all! A person's a person, no matter how small! And you very small persons will not have to die if you make yourselves heard. So come on now and try!" The mayor grabbed a tom-tom. He started to smack it, and all over Whoville they whooped up a racket. They rattled tin kettles. They beat on brass pans, on garbage pail tops and old cranberry cans. They blew on bazookas and blasted great toots on clarinets, oompas and boompas and flutes. Great gusts of loud racket rang high through the air. They rattled and shook the whole sky, and the mayor called up through the howling mad hullabaloo, "Hey, Horton, how's this? Is our sound coming through?" And Horton called back, "I can hear you just fine, but the kangaroo's ears aren't as strong quite as mine. They don't hear a thing. Are you sure all your boys are doing their best? Are they all making noise? Are you sure every who down in Whoville is working? Quick, look through your town. Is there anyone shirking?" Through the town rushed the mayor from east to the west, but everyone seemed to be doing his best. Everyone seemed to be yapping or yipping. Everyone seemed to be beeping or bipping. But it wasn't enough, all this ruckus and roar. He had to find someone to help him make more. He raced through each building. He searched floor to floor. And just as he felt he was getting nowhere and almost about to give up in despair, he suddenly burst through a door, and that mayor discovered one shirker. Quite hidden away in the Fairfax Apartments, apartment 12J. A very small shirker named Jojo was standing and bouncing a yo-yo, not making a sound, not a yip, not a chirp. And the mayor rushed inside and he grabbed the young twerp. And he climbed with a lad up the Ethelberg Tower. "This," cried the mayor, "is your time's darkest hour, the time for all who's, who have blood that is red, to come to the aid of their country," he said. "We've got to make noises in greater amounts, so open your mouth, lad, for every voice counts." Thus he spoke as he climbed. When they climbed to the top, the lad cleared his throat, and he shouted out, "Yop!" And that yop, that one small extra yop, put it over. Finally, at last, from that speck on that clover, their voices were heard. They rang out clear and clean, and the elephant smiled. Do you see what I mean? They've proved they are persons, no matter how small, and their whole world was saved by the smallest of all. "How true, yes, how true," said the big kangaroo. "And from now on, you know what I plan to do? From now on, I'm going to protect them with you." And the young kangaroo in her pouch said, "Me too." "From sun in the summer, from rain when it's fallish, I'm going to protect them, no matter how smallish."
Thank you, Marin, a marvelous storyteller. For those who just arrived, we've been reading Horton Hears a Who, Marin has, to help us understand community and trusteeship as it's a precursor to justice. And Duane, I'm also wondering, oh, we just left. I was going to ask him if we didn't have a new prophet named Horton.
Yes.
Okay, any observations as you've had a chance to listen to the story? In light of what does it mean to hold people in trust, and what does it mean to advocate for justice? What has Horton taught us?
Perseverance.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit more about that, Eva?
Well, he didn't give up. He was determined that there was a voice and that he needed to speak for them.
What was it that convicted Horton and helped him with perseverance?
Well, he was needed.
He was needed. And a real experience, right? He had a real experience. He heard. Others didn't, but he heard. He had a real experience which was undeniable to himself.
And he believed that a person's a person no matter how small.
Absolutely.
That's what, he didn't have a choice because he came from that.
So he had a foundational belief and an experience. Mm-hmm. And those two came together and he could do no other. Right? Here I stand.
I think it was interesting too though that the who's had to help themselves as well. He couldn't do all the saving.
Every single one of them was needed somehow.
Mm-hmm. Even the smallest voice. Mm-hmm. In fact, especially.
And yet the smallest one wasn't castigated for not joining in. He was pressed into, you know.
He was drafted. Right.
Great. And so that's wonderful. I mean, the smallest voice. And I like to think about that in terms of civic responsibility and discipleship, that we have to not only prepare ourselves, but how are we preparing the young people in our communities to understand that their voice counts. Marcelo?
I was thinking that the smallest ones are not sometimes very visible to many people, so it seems that the one that is big is visible, and we count that they exist and they are there. But sometimes we don't have eyes for the small.
Mm-hmm. I thought when Carl was here, you know, Carl who came to your class. Came to the forum. Now that was so impressive that he not only came but participated. How old was he? About 11?
11, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And at our church, which is Catholic, we don't have servers, but we have, what are they called? Who hold the book? Head sacristans. And they'll hold the book for the priest. And we have sacristans in training, and Will is one of those. He also, well, he does it once a month, and then there's several other high school and middle school kids who do it. And I like that model, because before it was just adults, and I think we really have to bring our kids into just discussions and liturgy. And another thing, everybody knows about the lack of candidates for priests in the Catholic Church and what some of the reasons are, but we have our priest now was retired, and his bishop let him come to take care of our small community. And he invites kids to come up on the altar with it for the consecration. And I just think, what better way to get kids to think about being priests than to have them up there with you? I just think it's such an insight to do that.
Thanks, Connie. What is it like for Horton when he hears the voices and convicted by his own principles, a person's a person no matter how small? What does he face initially from the community?
Ridicule.
Rejection, ridicule.
Disbelief.
Does that sound like the prophet's doing?
Yep.
So, how do we prepare our hearts for leadership? I have a friend who says this, that leadership is essentially, in its initial stages, count on it being lonely. Because if the people were already where you wanted them to be, it wouldn't require leadership. So leadership is about sometimes standing in the lonely place and inviting people to see things from a new perspective. Now, sometimes leadership can happen in communities, but when we do encounter the loneliness of expressing a prophetic voice or the loneliness of leadership. How do we prepare our hearts for that?
Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we actually, sometimes we're not lonely, sometimes we're harassed first.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sometimes we'd rather be lonely.
Ridicule and scorn, huh?
Mm-hmm. And then in Minnesota, we're just niced. And that's the hardest one of all to deal with, because you don't know that you're offended until you find out that you don't get that job that you need.
Mm-hmm. So why do it? I mean, why not just let the little speck of dust, you know, be plunged into the pool or boiled in bezelnut oil? I mean, after all, it's, who would know? No one can hear the who's. You'd get along a lot better with the village if you just, you know, went along and forgot about what you knew. Why not just go along to get along?
Because of that fire in the belly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The fire in the bones. And here, he made a promise. Or made the promise.
That's right.
The small. And once you make a promise,
it's a trust relationship.
Trust relationship.
And he does have that inner conviction that people are people no matter how small. And that's a part of him. That's a part of his being, I think.
I think it's how terrible it could be if the elephant could have acted against that value.
Yeah.
And how tragic that would be.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to explore the question of what does that phrase mean to us, people are people no matter how small. To me, it could mean a number of things. Thinking as a teacher in a classroom, for instance, there are so many kids that are not going to get rewarded for good scholarship because they're not good scholars by our standards. I mean, they don't learn verbally, they don't learn, they're not adept at abstracting verbally or mathematically. So they don't get the good grades, and they don't get the strokes. And yet there are kids there who are very capable of getting those same concepts if they could do it mechanically, if they could do it kinesthetically, they could do it experientially, but they don't have that opportunity. So they're sent to special ed where they do this, they're asked to do the same thing they do in the classroom, only in smaller groups.
And some of those kids are the future geniuses because they think in a different way than the norm. And if their needs are met somehow, if they're lucky enough, you know, that they have to have, and that's a good reason to support all the small voices, you know, because they may save the world someday.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, what he uses here in people are people no matter how small, the voicelessness is that cue, you know, that we have to realize how many people are without a voice, and pretty soon they're shamed into not using their voice,
mm-hmm.
and into the futility, you know, of even trying. And so it's that we must each be keen to listen for the voice.
That's a question as we begin to lean into Vespers. We're not quite there yet. A question I'd like to ask is, what voices are you hearing? Who are the who's that got your attention? And what advocacy, you know, is helping to bring voice where there might be, where voices might not be heard? So I'd like to hear from the group upstairs and down. Who are you? What voices are you hearing? What are you feeling a need to speak on behalf of? Connie?
Well, I want to go back to the forum where you said there's this part of the CIA that makes sure that there's insurrection in other countries or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to know more about that and what we can do about that.
Connie is referring to an organization within the CIA called the Center for Low Intensity Conflict, which is written up in very dramatic terms by Jack Nelson Palmyre in a book entitled War Against the Poor, which is in the Holden Bookshop. I've asked them to bring it out front to where the teaching staff books are, but it's also in the back. And just asked the bookstore manager for it. Jack is a Lutheran pastor and lived in Central America with his wife and family for about 9 years and directly encountered this organization. He would have conferences around the country talking about the Center for Low Intensity Conflict and bringing light to what they were doing, and then the Center for Low Intensity Conflict would have follow-up conferences right after he would to say, well, that's not quite right, this is what we do. And his work brought them out of the shadows. Jack concludes that one of the things that the CIA has been doing in this country is to place some of their agents in positions and organizations to intentionally distort the news to the American people. Because if the American people knew about American foreign policy overseas and its particularity, that most Americans would be morally offended. And so the belief is what we don't know won't hurt us. And that book, War Against the Poor, Connie, is a good place to find out more about that.
Gay and lesbian people, some of the little people, the voice,
Jen. Say it just one more time, Janet. Just
gay and lesbian people.
Okay, that's a voice I'm hearing, and gay and lesbian people, and how they're either not invited to the church or invited as long as they leave their identity behind.
Single parents also.
Mm-hmm. Illegal immigrants.
Homeless children.
What about the environment?
Mother Earth.
Not people, but mm-hmm. Mother Earth. Yeah.
Mother Earth.
The birds.
The elderly.
Yeah.
I mean, the really old people that are in nursing homes. And they never get visited, or seldom do. But even if they are, I mean, they're still forgotten.
I want to hear from some other voices that we haven't heard from. What voices are you hearing? People live in substandard housing.
Native Americans,
people on welfare.
Mentally ill. People with AIDS.
Immigrants, whether they are legal or illegal, but with the new welfare law, people are really scared.
One of the images, I can imagine Dr. Seuss picks for Horton is because he has such huge ears, you know. How do we get bigger ears?
Mm-hmm.
by reading things that, where we learn about these people.
Conscious contact and listening.
Thank you. Yeah. All right. No accents. Make relationships. Make friends with these people who've just been mentioned. Dwayne?
It comes to mind that refrain that ends several of Jesus' parables, and all. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. And we hear without hearing. And that sort of idea, just to sort of be tuned, you know, to what's going on and where the hurt is.
I heard someone share, if I could build on that for just a second, I heard someone share that, you know, Jesus as God, Jesus as healer, could have healed anything. And why did so many of his initial healings have to do with healing blindness and healing deafness? Yes. You know, what is that a metaphor for, that we would all see more and all hear more as the beginning of his ministry? That he invited more people to see and more people to hear clearly.
But in order to see and hear more clearly, you have to slow down and take the time to do all these things. You have to be willing to stop your fast pace to make a relationship with someone new. I think that's important.
You also have to make some choices. I mean, you can't be all things to all little fools. I mean, you can't. Can't.
I think that's a really important point. Horton chose that particular community to be his ministry. As we prepare I'm sorry, did I cut someone off, Ava?
I was just saying prayer and meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Hear the God voice leading you to the four new voices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's important. I'm just thinking about belonging to a small group of people who are willing to pray with one another, and what a great help that is, what a empowering thing that is.
That's an interesting thing that you raised, because I had just thought that would be a wonderful way to close.
That's if we could do that, I'd like to ask Maren to do that in. Just prior to that, I would like to say, as we prepare for Vespers, would you consider, just in your own heart, deciding of the communities that were mentioned as we went around the circle, what are you drawn to? And is there an offering that you could make in your mind and in your heart this evening during Vespers to do more for that particular group of who's?
Well, let's pray together. And dear God, you loved us and you have us in your care. And we know that in all things you work together for the good.